This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Chimps and chumps, and welcome to another evolutionary episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com, the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host, a man with whom I would like to engage in several secret projects. But then, of course, we put them on the internet so everybody hears them. So we're terrible at keeping secrets.
Terrible at secrets.
Terrible. Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How's it going?
Very well.
If you want to find more of our episodes, you can always go to our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. If you really like the show, what I would highly suggest you doing is joining up with the Junkion Army, all the generous folks out there who have pledged to our Patreon, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. For as little as $4 a month, you get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. Things like mailbags, things like our secondary summer series, Summer of 77, that just had its first entry last week. So lots of great stuff out there, lots of reasons to be patrons. And actually, my fiance thought of a great new incentive is that once my son is born in about 3 weeks, oh dear God.
Oh dear God.
She said that I should start posting pictures of my son Zane in different geeky onesies as thank you cards on the Patreon for you guys, because I won't be shy to tell you, the money that you give us is going to his daycare. So babies are expensive. Thank you so much for pledging. Patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.
This week, we have something really, really special.
Yeah, we do.
This is one of those movies that is the reason we founded Junk Food Cinema.
The reason for the season.
This is why we do it, you know. And
my other favorite Montel Jordan song.
Yeah. This is why we do it. But this is a film that I had not seen since it was in theaters 30 years ago. When it came out in theaters 30 years ago, I was there. I saw it twice in a theater. I loved it. But for some reason, I never revisited it. It was just one of those movies that kind of fell off my radar and stayed as that movie with Matthew Broderick and a monkey. And then we started talking about the potential of Summer of 87, and we started going down the list, and I go, oh, Project X. You said, what's Project X? And I'm like, Matthew Broderick and a monkey? Oh my God, I can't wait. And sure enough, this movie not only held up, it stayed really, really fucking good.
And that movie, of course, is Any Which Way But Ferris, and that is what we'll be talking about today. No. Actually, it's a different movie called Project X.
When Jimmy Garrett joined the Air Force, he knew he'd learn about leadership.
So why didn't you go to the Air Force Academy?
My instructors felt that I was spending too much time concentrating on football.
Football?
I ran a betting pool.
He'd meet interesting people.
Could I buy you a drink?
He'd work with space-age technology.
This is going to be a whole new experience. I just hope I'm up to it.
No, not you. Them.
These are monkeys.
But he never thought he'd meet anyone like Virgil.
Be a good boy, okay? Come here. Friend.
It was a top-secret project, and only Virgil knew the truth.
What's he doing?
I don't know, man. I mean, I've never seen this before.
I don't believe it.
I think your animal is the best qualified for our demonstration.
What's wrong?
Virgil.
You have to get him out of here.
Somebody lied to me. What am I supposed to believe?
Listen, they are doing top secret work here. If anybody knew that I even talked to you, I could be charged with treason.
What is his clearance? What is your clearance?
Starting countdown with King.
How fast can you get him out of here?
There's nothing you can do about it, man. Five, what do you think is going on down that tunnel?
Let's get the hell out of here.
Garrett, what the hell are you doing?
From the creators of War Games, Matthew Broderick, Project X.
There is only one Project X in this dojo, by the way.
I agree with you. I am notoriously on record as hating another movie called Project X.
2012, yeah. When I tweeted about it, people were like, wait, what? Oh, the one with Matthew Broderick. Yes, because the other one does not exist in this dojo.
I agree with you 100%. Sweep that movie's leg for sure. And in fact, when I posted on Facebook that we were going to be covering this movie this week, I referred to it as the Project X that Brian actually likes. I think you sold it to me as Matthew Broderick and a monkey. It's a movie that I had on VHS for many years, but like several other VHS I owned in my mammoth collection, I never got around to actually watching it.
Yeah, and for those wondering why, you would literally go to yard sales and swap meets, and you just buy them by the box.
Yeah.
And you'd get them. I remember you got a whole bookshelf full one day, and I walked in and I go, where the fuck did you get all this? And you're like, oh, my grandmother.
Yeah.
And I start going through the list and listing off titles. You're like, wait, is that good? I'm like, oh my God, Brian, you don't know what you have here. Yeah, this is Junkies. I'm telling you, this is like a junk food cinema greatest hits.
It is a reunion. Like the punch bowl's over there in the corner. We've hired the DJ. Welcome to the junk food cinema reunion.
There is one prominent person in this film that we have not mentioned in a previous episode. Every other person has been covered at some point in time, even in passing.
Interesting.
So we've got Matthew Broderick, who, of course, we covered Ferris Bueller last summer. We've got Helen Hunt, who we briefly touched on when we talked about Twister when we did the Bill Paxton episode.
Correct.
We've got William fucking Sadler.
Oh, yes.
In this movie. We've got Stephen Lang, people.
Stephen Lang.
And we'll get into it, but not nearly enough Stephen Lang.
Oh, no,
like,
no,
if
no,
this
no.
film has one failing, it is there's not nearly enough Stephen Lang, because whenever he's on screen, he's fucking great. We have a cameo appearance by the patron saint of junk food cinema himself, Dick Miller.
So here's what happened. I'm sitting there, and I expected this movie to be junky in all the best ways. I expected this movie to be entertaining. I did not expect this movie to be as high quality as it was, for one thing. And I started to get clued in as I'm watching the credits to this movie, which, by the way, opens like a Planet Earth documentary with Peter Gabriel's Shock the Monkey playing in the background.
First of all, how can you not love a movie about monkeys with Peter Gabriel's Shock the Monkey?
It's such an obvious joke that it's one I've made on an episode of Junk Food Cinema. When we did our Phenomenon episode, I literally edited that episode so we go out to Shock the Monkey because of what happens at the end of Phenomena. And so when it kicks up and I'm like, okay, I'm on board with how on the nose this is. But then I start seeing names in the credits. Like, first of all, I looked up the director, Jonathan Kaplan, because I knew I had heard that name before. It was driving me
crazy. Another alum.
It was driving me crazy. And then I was like, oh, the director of Truck Turner, a Corman University alum. Excellent. And then I see score by James Horner, and I'm like, get the fuck out of here.
Yes.
There's another Corman alum and another all-star of junk food cinema, probably owns his own spot on Mount Junk Food. Then shot by Dean motherfucking Cundey.
Yeah.
Dean Cundey, who shot everything pretty much that Carpenter ever did, plus, oh, I don't know, Back to the Goddamn Future. I'm like, okay, I'm starting to think about this. All these great names, and then all of these Corman alums. And it hits me. We are on a stage 5 dick watch. Dick Miller
could come out at any moment.
We're on a dick watch. Dick watch is on.
And they knock it out right in the beginning.
Right at the beginning of this movie.
Here it is. You barely see him on screen, but you hear his voice, and you hear that voice. It's like, it's Dick fucking Miller.
Hi, this is Dick Miller.
I want to take this movie from the top, though, because it changes and it becomes reminiscent. When it changes gears, it reminds me of so many different movies. And the opening of this movie, which had me a little, I was like, I don't know if this movie's going to really work for me, because it felt like the flashback from The Hills Have Eyes 2, because it's like we're seeing this movie from the perspective of the chimpanzee at the beginning, and I'm like, okay, this is an odd choice. But then it immediately switched gears, and, you know, Shock the Monkey's on, and we're showing how this chimpanzee goes from the jungle to ending up at a psychological research institute in Wisconsin, and on the loading dock, there's where we see the man himself, Dick Miller. It's like, oh, awesome. There he is.
Yeah. So what you guys need to know going in is this is probably one of the best animal rights movies.
It is.
That's ever been made. It really does. It's It's all about animal rights, and yet it's never heavy-handed about it.
It's not preachy, even as it's preaching, which is really impressive.
Yeah, it's got a very even tone. And it's what it is it's just showing you the connection between these two creatures, a man and a chimpanzee. And from that point, showing how abusive the system can be, even when everyone involved is entirely well-intentioned. That's the thing. This movie has a heavy, but he's not a villain. Like, no. He's just the antagonist. He's not, at the end of the day, what he's doing is not a bad thing, and you can actually sit down and debate whether or not the program that Project X is a part of has value or not. And they even do some great points at bringing that up and do it in the best way, in which it's exposed during conflict as opposed to ever lecturing you on anything. And so this movie can be discussed and debated about the nature of, do we need animal testing? However, what it does, in such an entertaining, heartwarming, and at times heartbreaking way that it's just pure enjoyment. Like, it just really is a movie that you sit down and go, this is a great movie. This is like, this may be among the very best things we will talk about this summer. Like, there's much bigger films, there'll be more prominent films, there'll be funnier films, but this film, like, pound for pound, I'm probably going to rewatch it again tonight after we get done talking about this,
because
it really is something that I just it's on my brain and I want to watch it again.
And it's crazy to think about, but yeah, it's a movie that really is about informed consent, if you're a research methods nerd, which is funny because that's really what Matthew Broderick is fighting for, is not even necessarily that the experiment is being done, but that the subjects the experiment are being done on don't know how much they're being affected by it because they're chimpanzees. And also, it's a movie that's taking really as big swipes at just the bureaucracy of the military as it is the testing itself, because the bigger issue isn't even necessarily that the testing is being done, it's that one of the subjects isn't supposed to be there. He's the Dante of the movie. He's not even supposed to be here today.
Yeah.
Because he was misfiled, and he's a chimpanzee that can speak sign language because he was taught by Helen Hunt, which is sort of, when we move away from the prologue, we get into how this chimpanzee learned to communicate. He was being taught by Helen Hunt's character. And then something happens where he's supposed to be moved to a zoo, but somehow ends up at this Air Force base where
by hook or by crook.
Right. Where we meet Matthew Broderick, who is basically just Lieutenant Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Because he's just Ferris Bueller in the Air Force.
Yeah, he's a fuck up. He doesn't have his shit together. He's a pilot who really wants to fly. He's just been grounded because he took a girl up in a plane in an unauthorized flight, and now is being busted down and is being but because he has a well-known hero dad, they're not going to bust him out. So they shuffle him off to clean monkey cages because literally that's what he's doing at the beginning.
Do you think when you sign up for the Air Force, like with all those high school recruiting tables that they do, do you think anyone who signs up ever thinks of the possibility that they will have to clean out chimp cages?
I can actually answer this question.
That's why I was asking.
I came very close to joining the Air Force. I'm a military brat, and my father is a 26-year veteran of the Air Force. And at one point, when, you know, things weren't going well and I didn't know which direction my life was going, I considered joining the Air Force. That kind of thing does cross your mind. But the thing is the recruiters give you that hard sell and they're like, oh, what do you want to do? You want to do this? Well, we'll put you in this and this will be this. And, you know, then you talk to other people and they're like, whatever you do, get it in writing. Don't listen to what the recruiter says, because you will end up cleaning a monkey cage. Like, that is they'll sell you on one thing and give you another. Now, not all recruiters are like that, but in generally speaking, get it. Kids, if you're deciding to go into the military and the recruiter tells you anything, get it in writing. Those type of things, whether it's specifically monkey cages or whether you're just worried about, you know, humping a radio through the muck in some foreign country when you signed up to be a disc jockey because you wanted to be Adrian Krodenauer.
Wasn't that a Barry White box set title, Humping the Radio? Was that I could have sworn it was
really
released
should
in the 80s.
Be. Yeah, okay. It kind of would be. But let's go back for a moment. We were talking about the cast, and there's one cast member we haven't mentioned yet, one prominent cast member, who has not been mentioned previously in Junk Food Cinema and probably should. She hasn't done enough junk food, and yet she's done enough recently that she's going to be on your brain. Because, of course, the Helen Hunt superior at the college is played by Jean Smart, who a lot of you will recognize instantly as the leader of the mutants in the new TV show Legion, which if you haven't seen Legion and you're a Junk Food Cinema fan, dear God, people, get out there and watch it. It is 8 of the best episodes that are on TV right now. It is so amazing, but she's fantastic in it, and she's great here. She's given very little to do. Sadly, her and Helen Hunt have kind of a thankless job. They don't really have much to do here, but they bring it to bear. Like they cement the heart of this film. We connect with Virgil by their interactions very early on at the beginning. So by the time this chimp Virgil ends up alone in a cage on an Air Force base, you're just heartbroken for him, and you're just in love with this little guy. And that's important because Matthew Broderick then spends the rest of the movie falling in love with this little guy, learning to communicate with this guy, and then ultimately trying to save this guy from a terrible experiment.
I feel like in most movies that are trying to accomplish this, it would be really saccharine or it'd be really slapsticky. Like, I feel like those are the two ways you have to go with animal movies in this time period, where it's either just real, real silly, or it's such an obvious tug at your heartstrings that it kind of turns you off. But this somehow manages to create a character out of Virgil, not just a chimpanzee who's doing things on screen. Like, there were points where, because this is going to sound horrible, but when I watch most animal movies, all I'm thinking about is the obvious trainer directly off screen and how they're manipulating this animal to get it to act because it clearly doesn't want to be there. I never felt that watching Project X. They did a really good job of between the actual animal training, the cinematography, and the pacing. They did a great job of creating a character out of Virgil, not just an animal on screen.
Yeah, no, he is a fantastic character too, with a, interestingly enough, a whole bevy of desires. Like, this one of the interesting things is that they don't just make him a team up for Matthew Broderick. He falls in love with another chimp. He's friends with other chimps. He's scared of other chimps. Like, you actually see his interactions with everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you see you see him pining for his past. Like, there's a great moment where a blonde airman walks in, and of course he remembers Helen Hunt and does this, you know, he's got the
sign for blonde hair.
Mm-hmm. And he sees her, but it's from a distance, and he thinks it's her, and he starts getting really excited and like doing, you know, the hair because he thinks his friend is back, and he misses her, and kind of flips out as a result when it's not her. And then, of course, so every time he comes out of a cage and grabs someone and hugs them.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. You melt. You fucking melt. 'Cause he's so adorable. Yeah. There's so much genuine love there. It's clear that part of the training of this movie was they spent a lot of time with Matthew Broderick and Helen Hunt getting to know Virgil so that Virgil would in fact, connect and bond with them. And you see that bond on screen. It's not training. It's like actual, there's a real bond there in some way, shape or form. And it translates so well. And it makes this movie what it is that leads up to an unbelievable stand up and cheer climax.
Well, it's crazy because, okay, so as we're watching this, we understand that this project is, they are training these chimpanzees to fly flight simulators. So that's what we're watching Matthew Broderick train Virgil to do. And, you know, it's, you got your sweet little montage where we're watching him learn how to do it. He's doing pretty well. And then they just, whew, man, do they yank the rug out from under us? Because we're watching Virgil, like, give a demonstration. And then they're like, okay, airman, step out of the room. And Matthew Broderick's like, okay. So he steps out. And then, like a fucking shark, like, this thing just slowly.
Well, it's not Virgil. That's not Virgil.
Oh, you're right. That's not Virgil.
That's Bluebeard.
Bluebeard. So this thing just rises up out of the floor, and you realize it's a nuclear reactor. And in a flash, they expose the chimp as he's flying to radiation. And one of the most haunting images in the entire movie is this slow motion they use to show the chimpanzee's reaction to being exposed to radiation, where it's just, it slows down and it just turns its head. And there is, I don't know how they achieved this humanely, but man, does it look like that chimp is in torment. Like, it is just, your heart breaks watching this. I mean, it's simultaneously really creepy and really heartbreaking.
Yeah. And then they repeat that shot a little later in the film.
Yeah.
And it's, they use it twice, and not repeating the same shot, but using the same technique to show another monkey getting exposed. And yeah, it rends. Like, there's I talked to a number of people about the fact that we were doing this, and several people remarked that they cry during the Bluebeard sequence.
Yeah.
That the Bluebeard sequence just destroyed them. And they're like, how could you watch the rest of the movie? It's like, 'cause the rest of the movie is so fucking awesome. Like, yeah. Like that's the menace. That's the threat. That's what we have to escape from. This is not a matter of we're doing these uncomfortable things to these animals and seeing how they respond. It's we're putting animals in a flight simulator, exposing them to lethal doses of radiation and seeing how long they can fly after that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of fucking awful.
It is the epitome of Cold War military experimentation, because the whole thought process behind this experiment is, if we have a pilot who's on a bombing mission over Russia and one of their missiles goes off and they have to fly through the fallout, how long can they still deliver the payload? Like, it is the most nightmarish of scenarios that they are preparing for.
Yeah.
And it's still like, you kind of see it from both sides of the fence. Because on the one hand, you're outraged. You're with Matthew Broderick. Like, this is absolutely heartbreaking and something you don't want to see. But at the same time, it's like, you understand why the military wants to know if this is possible.
Yeah. It's a legitimate experiment that they bring up real ethical questions of.
Yeah.
And really, at the heart of it is the ethical question of how they go about it. Because really, they never bring it up again in the film, but that's what the opening sequence is entirely about. It's about a mother and son chimps sitting on a termite mound, eating termites in paradise, and then hunters come up and presumably kill the mother and take Virgil, and then you see the awful trip that Virgil has to make across the world before he ends up, thankfully, in a college facility where he has a loving scientist who is trying to see if how intelligent chimps are and trying to teach him sign language. But then, because funding is cut, is then sent. It's a critique of the system, not the military.
Exactly.
Which is what I think is so fascinating about how even-handed this film is, because it's never, like, the thing is when Matthew Broderick goes rogue, he actually is going rogue. Like, this dude is doing shit he should not be doing, and really goes off the reservation, so to speak, to save Virgil, which you love as a protagonist. But man, is he putting himself in a situation where you're like, that's the dude who does 20 years in federal prison.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, that's that guy's being sent to the brig, and that guy may never see the light of day again. Or when he does, he'll be old, and, you know, it'll be 2017. It'll be like, you know, I just lost 30 years because I had to free a
monkey. Couple
assholes
will be talking about his movies on a podcast, right?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
So, it's really interesting how they deal with that and how they build the character of Virgil and against this, you know, terrible system of how they procure, you know, animals. You know, you kind of think of it like, oh, they must get them from breeders and things like that. And it's like, no, that's not really how that always works. And so the arc of Virgil is pretty fucking great. Over the course of this film, going from there, going through everything, and then where we end up.
Very much so. Oh, one other actor we didn't mention who I want to give a special shout out to is Daniel Roebuck, who plays another of the soldiers that are kind of on this base. Daniel Roebuck, if you haven't seen the movie Dudes with him and John Cryer, I highly, highly recommend that weird punk rock road western. Like, it is bizarre and wonderful.
Yeah, Dudes is on the on our long list. We call it a short list. It's a long list.
It's a long list.
But we'll cover it eventually, so take a drink, junkies.
That list is longer than Stephen Lang is in this movie.
Yeah. Daniel Roebuck, though, he's a guy, the minute you see him, you're like, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's that. He's like one of the chummy young Dick Millers of the 80s. Like, you, in the 80s and 90s, you just saw him everywhere.
Yeah.
So he only gets like one or two lines in the whole movie, which is why I didn't even list him off.
No, but it's crazy. Like we said before, this is a really interesting collection of people working. And by the way, one of the writers on this movie, Lawrence Lasker, I looked up his filmography. He's one of the writers on a little movie called Sneakers that we covered a few months ago.
Which would then be scored by James Horner.
Yeah.
And in fact, I was going to mention it, but I may as well mention it now since we're segueing. If you listen closely to this score, this score is a great score by Horner. It is not one of the, it's not amongst his very best. It just does everything it's supposed to do. But it is a beautiful bridge film. If you paid attention to his work, he borrows from himself a lot, which is part of what we love about him. And here he does that elegantly. This film is a perfect bridge between his work in the early 80s and his work in the 90s. The reason I mention this right here is if you listen during one of the scenes in which Matthew Broderick is slipping through the with Helen Hunt slipping through and sneaking into the facility on the Air Force Base, you hear a bit of Sneakers. Like, you hear him developing the early themes that he would then broaden and make so amazing in Sneakers. But also, if you listen, he does something very, very interesting here. He takes this horn flutter that he uses in Battle Beyond the Stars, Krull, and Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. And he always uses it for a villain theme. So it's the villain has a specific sound, which is da 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 da, and that na is kind of a triumphant up, like that it goes to that the villain is getting the upper hand, and that's what musically Horner is saying at that moment. Here he uses that horn flutter, but he takes the triumphant bit off it. And it only happens in the darkest scenes, when we're about to irradiate an orangutan or when someone's about to, like, get caught. You hear, da-na-na-na-na-na, and then that slowly builds to a down note as it gets more and more somber towards the end as things are going really, really bad. Because there is no triumphant villain in this movie. There is no real heavy. There's only the oppression of the system. And so he uses that to kind of build the tension in those moments, but there's no triumph in it. There's no, the villain is gonna be victorious, because there is no victorious here. And so I find it really interesting how Horner plays this score against the theme of the film. And it's only something that you really kind of notice when you put it together with his other works and see how he uses those same themes. And you'll notice a number of other smaller themes that he uses in his various films woven in here. And yet this doesn't feel like a copy and paste job either. Like he's plays around with some different styles and themes than we see in his other movies. But the one downside to this particular theme is there's no overarching definitive theme sound that this movie has, and that's rare for Horner.
There's nothing that would come back in a refrain.
Yes, it's except that horn flutter, which is only used during
up until that horn flutter happened. I was thinking to myself listening to this that it just doesn't sound distinctly Horner, and then of course that flutter happens and I'm like, oh, there it is.
Yep, there's the Horner we know. Yep. But yeah, so this is not one of those that you would ever pull out and go, I'm going to listen to his Project X score. But it is something that it's interesting to examine from a thematic perspective, because he really is diving deep into the movie here. And you can kind of extrapolate his process based on the, you know, his other works and what he does. And it would be interesting to watch something like Battle Beyond the Stars, follow it up with Project X, and then follow it up with Sneakers, and kind of listen to that progression through that 12-year period of his career.
I want to say this is probably an odd piece of praise, but Some of the best acting I've ever seen from Matthew Broderick is in one very specific moment of this movie. There's a moment where he realizes that because of the nature of the project that they're exposing these chimps to radiation, that they're going to die. And he realizes that as soon as it's Virgil's turn in the cockpit, Virgil's going to die too. So he make any, there's nothing, he feels like there's nothing he can do about it. So he does that thing where he is intentionally harsh to Virgil. He's trying to create distance because he knows that because they're so close, it's going to be difficult. So he's trying to basically sever this bond that he has with Virgil. He's doing it by being like just very aggressive with him. And Matthew Broderick, like, fighting through the sadness to try and like just chide Virgil for the smallest things and Virgil's reaction to it. Like, it is some of the best acting I've seen Matthew Broderick do, because it's a very complicated, like, juggling of emotions that he's doing in one very small moment of the movie.
You know, Matthew Broderick gets such a bad rap in terms of, you know, as an actor generally. Like, he's certainly not mocked. Like, everyone loves him, but he was an adorable comedy guy from the 80s. Like, he was, like, he was, you know, the Michael J. Fox you got when you couldn't get Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
But the thing is at that time, he did a lot of really great performances that are either forgotten or weren't really watched at the time. He did a bunch of indie movies. He did a bunch of smaller things. Movies like Biloxi Blues and Fire Song, Torch Song Trilogy. So he's done great stuff. But yeah, no, he's really bringing it in this movie. And he's really kind of going anti Ferris Bueller, or at least trying. You know, he's got his Ferris Bueller moments early on. But as the film develops, that all melts away. And he stops being the charming, funny guy. And like the moment when Helen Hunt shows up and asks to buy him a drink, and everyone's just kind of stunned, and he's like, he goes off with the pretty girl, and then he realizes who this is, and he's terrified, and he's like, oh shit, I gotta get the fuck out of here. And he does really, really great work throughout this. But yeah, no, that particular scene is great. In fact, that brings us to another thing that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet. Stephen Lang. I want to talk about Stephen Lang for a second, because first of all, we here at Junk Food Cinema love Stephen Lang.
He's slowly carving out his own visage on Mount Junk Food.
Well, he's one of those guys who I feel like he's one of those guys who just, he's always been around and everyone's worked with him because he's so fucking talented, but he never had that charismatic smart spark when he was younger that connected him to audiences. He never got those roles that people said, I want to see more Stephen Lang. And he aged into it. Mm-hmm. And now he's that old badass. He's our grizzled old dude who just refuses to get old and knows how to deliver the comedy, knows how to deliver the menace. And here it's perfect. It's just perfect distilled Stephen Lang. Like, he is playing this oddball guy running this facility, in charge of this facility for a very short period of time. And he has, I mean, it's such a great Stephen Lang moment when he's going to one of the monkey cages and he goes, the moon is in the seventh sign, but I'm in the sixth house. And the way he delivers it in a pure Stephen Lang way is just laugh out loud funny. But he then vanishes from the film. Yeah. And Matthew Broderick goes, what happened to him? And it's like, he couldn't hack it. He got attached. He just couldn't take it anymore. And what this is portenting what's going to happen to Matthew
Broderick. It's setting up exactly what happens with Matthew Broderick. And I want to go back for a second too. I don't think Matthew Broderick's a bad actor. I think the problem with Broderick is kind of the same thing that happened with Michael J. Fox, is that so much of their career and so much of their on-screen persona is their personality. They're very personality-based actors.
They're very charisma-based actors.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, after a while, when that's what you see them in, I think it develops an expectation that that's all that they can do.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's not the case with either one of those performers. So it was nice to see him have a moment like that. But yes, you're absolutely right about Stephen Lang. This movie suffers from a lack of Lang. It could have been so much more. And this is like the fifth or sixth movie we've talked about to feature Stephen Lang.
So. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because he really did show up in tons of great stuff. And just, you know, like in a cast like this, I mean, it's in a small, thankless role, getting swallowed up by, you know, Helen Hunt and Gene Smart and Matthew Broderick and who William Sadler. Yeah. Like William Sadler, this is another one of those great William Sadler roles that like they don't let him go out and have as much fun as you see in stuff like Shawshank.
Or Die Hard 2.
Like he's not allowed to go big. He's very restrained in this. But in doing so, he is a perfect foil to Matthew Broderick. Like he's not a bad guy. He's just running an experiment for very good reasons, and he's being cold and clinical and detached, and he plays it that way. Even when he's praising Matthew Broderick, he feels a little cold and clinical in a way that, you know, is not, you know, Sadler phoning it in. Instead, it's just the opposite. He's like completely immersed himself in this just kind of this menace. And he, every time he's on screen, you're just terrified that he's going to, you know, rip into Broderick in some cold way. Like he's gonna, you know, he's gonna do something terrible to Virgil. Like something's going to happen. You just feel that, and it's and he's likable enough in scenes, but you just know, and it's always there. And I think it's a really good performance by Sadler. Like this is definitely, oddly enough, an actor's film. Like this is a movie that could have easily gone off the rails, could have gotten goofy. This is, I mean, keep in mind, this is only a few years after we've got movies like Every Which Way But Loose and Going Bananas.
You didn't think that was an actor's film? Pretty sure it was. I'm amazing in that.
Clyde Trash the Caddy. yeah, but there's none of that here. Like it doesn't get silly. Like they allow the chimps to be chimps, and there's some good fun scenes with the chimps, but like some of the best stuff with the chimps is the chimps being emotional with one another, and how they milk great moments, like the when they find out that one of the monkeys came from a circus, and he loves to smoke because he used to smoke at the circus, that was one of his bits. And that he loves cigarettes, and watching the monkey kind of smoke and them be kind of like, wow, this is not a thing that should be happening. It's just kind of fun. But like when we start learning sign language with Matthew Broderick, like we start realizing that Virgil is talking to him. And, when they get to a point where we've learned enough of the sign language that we understand the conversation between Matthew Broderick and a chimpanzee
with no translation. That's when it gets. That is the thing about this movie when it gets into high drama that it's doing very well is when they have conversations that they have set up. You know, check off sign language. They've set up specific signs that we've seen earlier in the movie so that when they happen again in poignant moments, we don't even need it to be translated.
Yeah.
And it's so effective.
And then when he talks him into letting him out so that he can go get an apple and give an apple to his girlfriend, it's just such a sweet moment.
Yeah.
And then there's the moment where he wants to be let out and go hang out with his girlfriend, and they start running off, and he's like, don't go too far, and they immediately turn and break and then go and sit down with their arms around each other, and that's it. And it's just, it's so sweet.
Yeah.
And it just all of that works. But it's funny because, like, two of the, you know, Virgil out is, like, one of the big things throughout the film.
You might as well call that Brian out, as in I was out of control of my emotions when I saw that. When he does it at the end of the movie, it's like, out, and I'm like, yep, me too. I'm crying like a little girl right now.
Someone on Twitter said, the only way I'm going to watch that is if a monkey shows up at the end with a towel around its head. And then I was just, I'm sitting there and I'm like, I kind of want Virgil to walk out with the towel around his head and then point to the audience and go, you out.
Out.
You, what are you out.
What's the sign for what are you still doing here? The movie's over. Because I will learn that.
So let's talk about this end. This end.
Well, before we get to the end, okay. I want to talk about the two movies this movie becomes before we get to the end.
Okay.
The first movie it becomes is Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh,
because
yes.
We walk in and Virgil and the other chimps have gotten out of their cages, and Virgil is on top of this homemade tower to the skylight that he has built, and he's just bashing on it with a stick trying to break it open, and he's basically rallied all of the other chimps to, like, keep the guards out, and, like, he's got, like, this whole master plan going on. It just reminds me so much, like, I was 2 seconds away from being like, he's gonna jump down off that pile and just go, no! Because it felt exactly like that scene.
You kind of feel like Caesar is somewhere in that facility.
Oh, he's in there. Caesar's in there.
Caesar's in there.
Rest assured, Caesar is in there. And then when that fails, but they get out of that room, it becomes Gremlins. Like, the way they shoot these chimpanzees getting into mischief, the way the music is playing, like, just the general kind of feel of what these guys are getting into, it feels like a fucking Gremlins sequel.
Sir, we've got monkeys. Monkeys are everywhere. Yeah, no, they start wreaking havoc.
And then having Dick, by the way, having Dick Miller open this movie and then there's Gremlins moment, I was like, okay, it's not an accident that there's so many Corman alums, because who else was a Corman alum? Oh, just Joe goddamn Dante.
Yeah.
So it just was like, I feel like I'm watching Gremlins with chimpanzees, and I never knew until this moment how desperately I wanted to see that.
Yeah, yeah, and it's and it allows you to have fun without getting silly. That's one of the other things. Again, The even tone of this movie, there are no moments that you got to go, yeah, well, I mean, it gets a little silly with this. No, it stays, the tone stays. Like, these monkeys are breaking out. These monkeys want to be free. These monkeys do not want to be in cages anymore. They do not want to die. Some of them know. Like, the moment Virgil sees Bluebeard on the table and realizes the red collar means death, is a rough scene. And then it plays later. Like,
I don't know if I can do this, Carter. I don't know if I can finish this podcast. This is really starting to get to me. Oh, man. I'm dead serious.
It's this movie. It's what works about this movie is it's a great story goes to dark places so that we can achieve the greatest triumphs.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the things that I tell people about, like, Game of Thrones, where people are like, it gets too dark. It's like, yeah, it gets dark. How, you know, if it doesn't get dark, then how are you going to achieve a great victory? Like, that's part of what I see the problem with movies that are happening today that people just aren't connecting with, is these movies are forgetting it's not a straight line from beginning to end. You gotta put these people in real danger, you gotta put them in real menace, and it's gotta get really dark before you can see the light. And this movie does that. Like, that is a thing, is when you're watching this movie and you get to the Bluebeard scene, you got to muscle through it. You got to know that this is going to lead. Trust me, I would not steer you wrong on this. It is not a movie where all the monkeys are going to end up gassed. Like, this is, trust me on this. But yeah, so you've got them breaking out at the end. You've got this madness. And then we get to this great sequence where they have bust, they're smashing the plane. They're destroying the simulator. And they accidentally bring up the reactor. And then the reactor gets caught in there. And then it's all about everyone trying to save the base. Like, and literally including Virgil. Like, Virgil plays a part in this end, but they're trying to, in such a triumphant and yet very sad sequence, trying to get this reactor to go back down before it overloads. And it leads to it's just such a great.
Oh, that's the other movie it becomes that I almost forgot about, is Wrath of Goddamn Khan. Because, like, all the. Oh, okay.
Yeah, we got to save
the ship.
Yeah. You've got the Spock moment. Yeah, you're right. I didn't even think about that. There's totally the Spock moment.
They're on the opposite sides of the glass, and it's like, no, don't do that. You'll die, but you'll save the planet. Oh, I can't do this. Oh, man.
This movie messed with you, didn't it?
It really, and you know, it's surprising, because even though I said you sold this to me on Matthew Broderick with a chimp, if there's one type of movie I have never given a shit about, it's monkey movies. Like, Dunstan checks in, I checked out. Going bananas, go away.
But you love Phenomena.
I love Phenomena because that monkey kind of serves a function toward the end, but it's not a monkey movie. Or, like, Any Which Way But Loose, I will watch Any Which Movie But That. I don't like these. It's not my thing. I like dogs. I love movies with dogs in them. But for some reason, I don't know, like, if it's a CG ape, like that's not true. I know if they're real apes, that's when I don't care. Because I love the Planet of the Apes movies. I love that franchise. But there's not a real goddamn ape to be found in those movies. It's all Roddy McDowell and plastic coconut face.
Oh, you mean the old Planet of the Apes.
Oh, yeah. And then the new ones are just CG apes. So, like, that still holds true. Anytime you put a real monkey on screen, 9 times out of 10, I am watching anything else. But this movie managed to really get me. And it got me in the ways that are normally in animal movies reserved for dogs. Like, it, I was really blown away with how much this movie moved me.
Well, and to the director's credit, I feel that's very much that that's very much him and the editor. Like, really, how this movie is paced. If you watch how this movie is presented, when the first time Matthew Broderick walks into that room, that room's kind of scary. It's intimidating. Mm-hmm. Like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, I don't belong here, and these things are scaring me. And you're kind of nervous with Matthew Broderick as he's going to try to put a leash on a monkey, on a chimp. And then as the movie builds, Matthew Broderick personalizes all the monkeys and acknowledges them as other beings and then starts putting names on their, mm-hmm. their cages. And we start getting as attached to them as he does. And then by the end of the movie, we are attached to them. You're attached to more than Virgil at the end. You love Goofy. You feel for Bluebeard.
Oh, my God.
You love Goliath.
When they're escaping in the airplane toward the end of the movie.
Well, that was we were going to get to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is this triumphant end of this movie. If you've not watched this movie by now, we're about to spoil the fuck out
but
of it. God damn it.
Specific to the point you just made, I remember, and it's crazy. There's three of them in the back, and I'm like, where are the rest? Where are the rest? Like, I got really, like, anxious because I'm like, it wasn't that they were all in the plane and they were about to escape. I'm like, there's only three of them in there. Where are the other two? Because this movie had done a really effective job of, like you said, personalizing all the chimpanzees to the point that I'm like, I don't want this to be like Great Escape. Like, I don't want, you know, three of the British apes round up and shot. I want everybody like Steve McQueen to fucking motorcycle their way over this fence.
Well, most of them do get rounded up, but five of them get out of the facility. And yeah, when they finally get in the plane, Matthew Broderick, the pilot, is going to fly again. He's finally in the air. He's about to get in the air. He goes to take off and they stop him. And they get the pointed guns and you're like, oh, this is the point in the movie where Matthew Broderick floors it and they just don't shoot and they get away. And it's like, no, Matthew Broderick and Helen Hunt get out of the plane and you're like, oh shit, how the fuck are they going to get out of this now? And then it dawns on you and realize,
oh yeah,
they taught these monkeys how to fly. That's what this whole movie's been
about.
Which is
really shooting yourself in the foot, if you think. Like, you're going to teach the monkeys to fly a plane and then you're just going to leave them in a plane with the keys still in it and not expect them to fly.
Well, but nobody, like, it's the MPs. The MPs have no idea what these monkeys are for. They don't know. They have no idea these monkeys are trained to fly. And then there's that brief moment where, oh God, please don't let Goofy take the controls.
Which is just a mantra for life in general.
And then Virgil, who, by the way, has spent the entire movie dreaming of flying. Like, that's one of the things. Like, the movie opens up with him watching a bird, and, you know, one of the things he communicates to Helen Hunt at the beginning of the movie is he's fascinated by birds. He plays with this bird mobile, and he really wishes he could fly, which is why he gets really good as a pilot, because he's always dreamed of flying. And
he's basically like someone's been leaving little origami swans throughout the whole movie, this whole thing about him wanting to fly.
Yeah, and what I find really fascinating about that concept is that ultimately, at the end of the day, that's what he and Matthew Broderick have in common, is they both want to fly. They don't belong in the ground. They want to be in the air. And
it's not the 98% of genetic makeup that they share. It's their mutual love of flying that really brings them together.
Well, it doesn't bring them together, but as characters, it's a fascinating parallel, and it's handled really well. It would be very easy to have included a scene that kind of hit that on the head and was just right on the nose, and instead they don't. It's just this deftly handled theme. So then you get that moment where Virgil goes up and gets in the front seat and you're like, fuck yes. And then he looks at Matthew Broderick and gives the symbol. And then Matthew Broderick gives the symbol and fucking Virgil presses the button and sets the flaps and takes the fuck off. And then flies off into the Everglades, which they have very carefully set up throughout the movie. They've never nailed home that we're right outside of a swamp, but they've dropped the hints throughout the entire movie that we are clearly out near the wilderness. And then the plane goes off and then the plane goes down and you're like, oh no. And they're out there looking for the chimps, but the chimps aren't in the plane. And then there's that great moment where Virgil is hiding from the trees with his girlfriend and looks at Helen Hunt and Matthew Broderick, who are in custody, and says, me out. And then Helen Hunt signs for you free. And then Virgil and his girlfriend go off into the Everglades together, and it's just the sweetest, fucking most triumphant of possible endings for this. It's so good. It's so well handled, and it's just so fucking satisfying. And the movie as a whole is just fucking great.
Yeah. That moment when he does the sign for that's the moment you don't need any translation, is when he does that sign again for I fly. He's asking, and Matthew Broderick's just like, yeah, you fly. And then at the end with the year, oh God.
Man, you have never gotten this emotional.
It may be, okay, so I just moved and I haven't slept in like the last couple weeks, so it may
and
be.
And you're about to have a kid.
So I'm like super emotional anyway, and like, fuck, did this movie work me over. I felt like, I don't know, I felt like a punching bag by the time this was over. I'd been worked over big time, but it's a beautiful movie. It is a well-made, highly dramatic, but those moments of comedy, they keep the movie from being heavy-handed. It really is like, it's like a well-made sword, you know, like, it is very well balanced, like from tang to tip, and I loved it. I absolutely loved this movie, and I thought it was the perfect amalgam of all these different talents, a lot of whom we've talked about before, and yeah, I think it just works on every level, and it's a very surprising film because I'd heard of it before, but it's not a movie I hear a lot of people talking about.
No, it's kind of been relegated to history as the Matthew Broderick or the Monkey movie, and it's like when I post about it today, there's a handful of people that are like, oh my God, I loved that movie, but people just haven't watched it.
Well, let us be the first to tell you, it holds up.
If for some reason you've gotten this far and you still haven't watched it yet, it's on Netflix right now.
Streaming. Nice
so
and
you
easy.
Can see it for free. So if you don't have Netflix and you listen to Junk Food Cinema, wow.
Yeah.
Unexpected.
Wow. Yeah, it's there. It's streaming. Easy peasy, chimpanzee.
I'm through. I'm dead. I'm done.
So that brings us to the junk food pairing. And this week, I actually... I found myself in need of, like, after the emotional gamut this movie put me through, I needed something cold, an adult beverage to kind of even me out. So I went for, there's a brewery in Kansas City that makes Flying Monkey beer in a variety of styles. And I thought, you know, what better way to take the edge off of the emotional roller coaster that is this movie than by drinking a Flying Monkey beer. And maybe if you're like Goliath and you're needing a cigarette as well. Not a terrible idea. I mean, it is a terrible idea, kids, if you're listening. You know, the opinions of Junk Food Cinema do not represent those of Junk Food Cinema. Please don't sue us. But a cigarette and Flying Monkey beer, maybe a good combination for...
I would kind of like to go out. To go the full junk food. I would go for a peanut butter nanner sandwich.
Oh, that's also good.
Like a peanut butter nanner sandwich is like toast the bread, put a nice smear of crunchy peanut butter on there, then slice up some slices of bananas.
That's the most. That is the junky. Most. Thank you so much for listening to this episode on Project X. If you would like to hear our previous projects, you can find them on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. Hey, if you go to iTunes, please, we've gotten a lot of really great reviews and 5-star ratings recently. Thank you very much for that. Please continue to do that. That helps more and more people discover the podcast. And we really do appreciate it.
We cannot stress how important it is for the algorithm that this is how iTunes figures out that it should recommend the podcast.
We were
other
briefly
people.
On that list. There was one day we were briefly on that list, and I got so excited. And I don't know how this shit works or how it fluctuates, but we were on that list briefly, so I want to see it happen again. So leave those reviews. We really do appreciate that. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. We love talking to you guys. Like, I will converse with people on Twitter all the time. Through our account. Cargill does it through his own account. So, you know, get at us on Facebook, get at us on Twitter. We really, like, we are not a show that ignores when you guys talk to us. Like, we love talking about movies with people, and you have all proven yourselves to be like-minded junkions with a lot of knowledge, and it's really awesome to get to shoot the shit about movies with you. So please continue to do that. And if you really like the show and want to support it, make sure it sticks around for a long time, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. We also have Amazon links. If you click on it, it'll be in the show notes. Even if you don't buy the thing that we have posted the link for. If you get to Amazon through that link, anything you buy, we get a cut of. So thank you very much. And Cargill, now that I'm done standing all over this ceremony, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me at Twitter, twitter.com/massawyrm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or Facebook, facebook.com/massawyrm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury or facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. We're going to end the show reminding you to fox the fox, rat the rat. You can ape the ape, but don't you know when you're going to shock the monkey?
Hi, this is Dick Miller.
Who are these guys?